A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 24. Okay, well, last week we covered some of the ways that James sort of turned up the pressure on the church and kind of got them to give up ground sort of inch by inch. We'll see today how he further exploits it. So we're going to start with a bit of a bizarre account of something called the Gowrie Conspiracy. This is only partly relevant to the class, but it's kind of interesting, so that's why I'm reading it. No, it does come up, but it's probably you'll see the sensationalistic value if it exceeds the relevancy to the class. But this James had been out hunting, and let's see, I want to pick up Otto Scott's account of this. Let's see. The kill was made at about 11 o'clock in the morning, and the king told the Duke of Lennox he was proceeding to Gowrie House with the master to, quote, pick up a treasure. The courtiers, apparently under instructions, were to wait for fresh horses and follow later. They also sent for swords, a preparation that throws a strange light on what occurred afterward. The Earl of Gowrie, the 24-year-old older brother of the master, seemed surprised to see them, but escorted the king into the house. A little later, James was ushered into a small room on the ground floor where he was served dinner alone as a mark of respect. The courtiers, who arrived shortly afterward, ate in the great hall. After finishing his meal, the king and the young master of Ruthven went upstairs together. The courtiers by then scattered about with the larger number in the garden. Time passed and the men grew impatient. Someone said the king had left and men ran for their horses, the Earl of Gowrie among them. At the gate, however, the porter said no one had departed. They returned and were milling about the courtyard when they heard a shout. Looking up, they saw James's face at a turret window. "Help, my lord Mar, treason, I'm being murdered." The king's hat was gone, his face was red, and a hand appeared over his mouth. The men pounded up the stairs, sword in hand. John Ramsay, the page, was first on the scene. The young master of Ruthven was on his knees. James had his arm around the master's head, and the master's hand was raised, searching for the king's face as though to stop his shouting. Other men piled in behind Ramsay, and the king cried, "Strike him high, he has a chain doublet on him." Ramsay flew at the master with his dagger and slashed him on the neck and face. The young man arose, staggered back, and fell down the stairs. He time only to say, "Alas, I was not to blame," when Harry's ran his sword through him and killed him. At this point, the Earl of Gowrie came panting up the stairs and, looking about, asked for the king. The men turned and cut him down. Let's see. The melee, the shouts, the stamping feet had sent the servants of Gowrie House running for help. The great bell of the town was tolled, and townspeople came running. Local officials gathered their forces and arrived on the scene. People milled outside in a state of high excitement. As the news ran through their ranks that the young Earl of Gowrie and his brother, the master of Ruthven, had been killed by the king and his courtiers, their mood shifted instantly. Shouts rose against James. "Come down, thou son of Signor Davy," they cried. The skies overhead darkened, it began to rain. It was evening and the crowd was dispersed by the bailie and his men before the king emerged, surrounded by his men, to return to Falkland. Okay, so that's the sort of publicly told version. Then the king had his own story. As Otto Scott says, it was a tale from the lower levels of fiction, incredible and fantastic. The master of Ruthven, according to James, had approached him with a story that he'd discovered, and taken into custody, a mysterious stranger was carrying a pot of gold coins. Taken to Gowrie House, he and his brother the Earl decided the king should be informed. "During the hunt," said James, "the master had continued to urge the king to come to Gowrie House and view the treasure. After the kill, the king decided to make the trip and told Lennox of it. Lennox then sent for fresh horses and swords, being suspicious. After dining, the master took the king to the turret room, pausing en route to lock the door of every room they passed through. Once in the turret room, James was confronted by a man in armor with a dagger in his belt. The master of Ruthven took the dagger, confronted the king, and told him he must die. James then turned the force of his marvelous eloquence upon the two, and the man in armor, overcome by these compelling arguments, opened a window. The king then called for help while Ruthven struggled with him, but James overcame the young man. Everyone knew the rest. What happened to the locked rooms through which the courtiers raced without impediments? Where did the man in armor go? Nobody knew. The king, however, not only produced that explanation, but made it clear it had to be accepted. The ministers were summoned and heard the tale and were told to repeat it to their congregations. Their reactions reflected incredulity. "I see, Mr. Roberts," said the king to one, "that you would make me a murderer. It is known very well that I was never bloodthirsty." So, anyways, This is this bizarre story. I guess, you know, very little is known about it beyond, you know, what we have here. Certainly the truth of what actually happened, no one knows at this point. But since his account was not only not believed by the Church of Scotland, it wasn't believed elsewhere, he felt like he had to, I'll say here, have the lie told more widely. So if you tell lots of lies, if you tell the same lie over again lots of times. He ordered the ministers to give thanksgiving for his narrow escape. And then he got the church to have an annual day of thanksgiving. This was a couple of years later, 1602. But for a church that wouldn't celebrate Christmas, it was somewhat ridiculous to celebrate the king's escape from this dangerous situation. Apparently. You'll see that they're going to get quite overrun with bishops and everything shortly, so it will be somewhat easier. Okay, so the next General Assembly was held at a Scottish town, which I will pronounce as Bertisland. I'm waiting for Dr. Rees to offer me an alternative correct pronunciation. It's spelled literally Burnt Island. So I don't know if it's Burntisland or Burntisland or something completely different. But anyway, that was in May 1601. And James, we'll say, evidently sinking in the polls, just speaking facetiously here, due to Gowrie-gate, evidently felt the need to ingratiate himself with the church. He gave one of these flowery speeches, and His Majesty, this is quoting from McCree, His Majesty rose and addressed them with great appearance of sincerity and pious feeling. He confessed his offenses and mismanagements in the government of the kingdom, and lifting up his hand, he vowed in the presences of God and of the assembly that he would, by the grace of God, live and die in the religion presently professed in the realm of Scotland, defend it against its adversaries, minister justice faithfully to its subjects, discountenance those who attempted to hinder him in this good work, reform whatever was amiss in his person or family, and perform all the duties of a good and Christian king better than he had hitherto performed them.
This is not Easter,
so. No, this is in May, so. But. Okay. So he got the assembly then to give a similar pledge to do their duty, and you could call this a public relations ploy, I probably would, but he got this publicized in the pulpit the following Sabbath. So, to convince the people of His Majesty's good dispositions and of the cordiality which subsisted between him and the church. So, but you'll see, this is just like, this is one day, that was then, this is now. He'll soon be off on other things, but the assembly also began considering a revision of the translation of the Bible and of the metrical version of the Psalms. And James apparently impressed the assembly with his knowledge of the original languages, sort of pointing out, you know, problems with the translation, and he recited verses of the Psalms, demonstrating, you know, problems with either the meter or the translation. So, yes?
Did he really have that sort of knowledge of the language? Did he grasp it that well so that he could do that? Or did he have somebody do it for him?
He wasn't a modern king. He actually knew that stuff. Apparently he did. Yeah, I mean, he had this very thorough education, and that was this was really sort of part of his I'd see it as a problem, but he viewed himself as a real expert on all these issues. In fact, he not only viewed himself as an expert on the issues, he really could never see anyone else's viewpoint. He always assumed that if anyone would argue with him, that he could convince them that, you know, he was right and they were wrong. So, yes, as far as I know, this is all sort of legitimate from his actual knowledge of the translation and so on. So, okay, and then in June of 1602, Andrew Melville was preaching against the unfaithfulness of some of the ministers, and apparently some of the bishops, king's counselors, took offense at this. And this was brought up to the king, and he wrote a lettre de cachet, which ordered Melville to be confined to the precincts of his college at St. Andrews. So he was, I guess you could call it something like house arrest, but and if he left, he was to be put to the horn and forfeit all of his worldly possessions. So it was a pretty... put to the horn. Yeah, that means he was declared to be a rebel and a traitor. And I don't know exactly where the phrase comes from, but except maybe...
Under death sentence?
Well, not sure, but certainly would forfeit all his possessions if he left the... precinct. So it's a pretty serious sort of form of house arrest. Okay, well, on the 24th of March in 1603, Elizabeth died. And in fairly short order, James left to go to England, where he was proclaimed king. And this, basically, there had been a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiations going back and forth. So this was no great surprise, although apparently the English Privy Council was meeting to finalize the arrangements, and the Earl of Northumberland or someone came in and said if James wasn't declared king, you know, he had how many troops to go to war. But it was all a done deal at that point. So before he went, he went to St. Giles Church in Edinburgh and again made this sort of flowery speech about how happy he was with the state of the Scottish Church, how he had no intention of further changes. And then he also, to show how beneficent he was, he gave Andrew Melville leave to travel within a 6-mile radius of St. Andrews. So, okay, so James left for England, and there's all these interesting accounts of how, you know, what he did on his way down. He met with various people. He apparently made it his practice to... release everybody from jail in the town that he was in, except for certain offenses. And he did that, but then one place there was a pickpocket caught in the crowd. He had him executed on the spot. And wag wrote, well, if a man may be executed without a trial, and then surely he may be tried without having offended. Anyways, Scott calls him, says he considered himself to be the Lord of life and death, you know, that he was, so. On the way down, he was presented with something called the Millenary Petition. Millenary because it had 1,000 signers. But it was a list of grievances that the Puritans, the nonconformists, hoped that... the king would give thought to in terms of their sort of sanctioning their nonconformity. They haven't actually seen the text of the petition, but one of James's biographers said that the actual grievances in the petition weren't very radical. They were actually pretty reasonable requests, and that even a number of the bishops would have agreed with certainly some of them. He said the issues primarily related to the fact that the Puritans wanted a preaching ministry, so at least especially in country churches, apparently there was an emphasis on liturgical worship without preaching, so just kind of a liturgical worship service. I was going to say a mumbo-jumbo service, but... I don't think quite that, no. No. There was something related to the view of sacraments, whether the communion should be altar-wise or table-wise. So again, the priest handing it out or exactly the view of communion, and also related to the purity of worship. This is kind of an interesting difference between James and Elizabeth, but... this biography, which is McElway, said, on all these points, Elizabeth not only avoided involving herself in argument, but did her best to prevent any public discussion. To James, on the other hand, they not only offered problems of genuine fascination, but also, since he knew himself to be an expert, a splendid opportunity to show off. So, see, James, he liked all this kind of discussion and argument, and since he always won, of course, that was probably one of the reasons he liked it. Okay, but what quickly became clear was that he viewed the Puritans in England, And I, you know, having relatively little knowledge of the situation, but it's just sort of, you know, the brothers of the ministers in Scotland that he didn't like. So he, you know, quickly sides with the bishops. So what he did was he called a meeting in January of 1604. It was called the Hampton Court Conference. And he invited some representatives of the Puritans. He didn't invite them to send representatives. He invited specific representatives of the Puritans to come to this meeting. And he invited bishops of the Church of England, the archbishops and some high bishops, so to discuss the issues before him where he could sit in judgment. To give you a feeling for James's perspective here, I found his opening address on the web. I found it at the homepage of the British monarchy, www.royal.gov.uk. So I just did a search on Alta Vista, you know, and I kind of go down and I see, you know, opening address, and it's on the webpage. It's even got a little picture of him here. So let me just, this is not too long. It is no novel device, but according to the example of all Christian princes, for kings to take the first course for the establishing of the church both in doctrine and policy. To this the very heathen related in their proverb, a Jove Principium. Particularly in this land, King Henry VIII, towards the end of his reign, altered much. King Edward VI more. Queen Mary reversed all. And lastly, Queen Elizabeth, a famous memory, settled religion as it now standeth. Herein I am happier than they, because they were fain to alter all things they found established. Whereas I see yet no such cause to change as confirm what I find settled already. So he sort of opened the very beginning of the speech by saying that basically liked things the way they were. Okay. For blessed be God's gracious goodness, who hath brought me into the promised land where religion is purely professed, where I sit among grave, learned, and revered men, not as before elsewhere, a king without state, without honor, where beardless boys would brave us to the face. He didn't like it in Scotland when the ministers told him what they thought. Okay, there's a little ellipsis here, so they're just excerpting this next paragraph. I assure you, we have not called this assembly for any innovation, for we acknowledge the government ecclesiastical, as it now is, to have been approved by manifold blessings from God himself, both for the increase of the gospel and with a most happy and glorious peace. Yet because nothing can be so absolutely ordered, but something may be added thereunto, and corruption in any state, as in the body of man, will insensibly grow, either through time or persons, and because we have received many complaints since our first entrance into this kingdom, of many disorders and much disobedience to the laws, with a great falling away to popery, our purpose, therefore, is, like a good physician, to examine and try the complaints, and fully to remove the occasions thereof, if scandalous, cure them, if dangerous, and take knowledge of them, if but frivolous, thereby to cast us off into Cerberus's mouth, that he bark no more. And if you'll see that that's basically what he's going to do, is cast us off into his mouth, that the Puritans bark no more. Okay, so basically the upshot is that on all the significant issues he sided with the bishops, on some of the non-controversial ones, he was somewhat more congenial, but he didn't really, I mean, in terms of having, say, more of a preaching ministry, that wasn't in and of itself necessarily controversial, but the, it's one thing to agree to it, it's another thing to make a plan for how to do that, and he just sort of agreed to it. But the Puritans, they made a mistake at the end of the conference. I mean, sort of up to that point, they hadn't really lost anything, they hadn't gained anything, but they hadn't lost anything because he was just confirming the status quo. They raised the issue of church government, and they suggested a compromise with the episcopal form that would include a presbytery to advise the bishop. So using the word presbytery in front of James is like waving a red flag in front of a bull. And he said, "Your Scottish presbytery as well agreeth with the monarchy as God and the devil. Then Jack and Tom and Will and Dick shall meet, and at their pleasures censure me, and my counsel in all our proceedings. Then Will shall stand up and say, it must be thus. Then Dick shall reply and say, nay, Mary, but we will have it thus." And goes on. "Stay, I pray you, for 17 years before you demand that of me. And if then you find me pursy and fat, my windpipe stuffed, I will perhaps hearken to you. For let that government be once up, I am sure I shall be kept in breath." So They didn't get anywhere with the Presbyterial argument. So. He also threatened at the end to harry them out of the country if they wouldn't conform precisely to the bishop's directives. So they really didn't get anywhere with this conference, and looking at it, it was of special concern to the Scottish ministers, because right about then meetings began, the possibility of a union between Scotland and England. Right. Now, as it turned out, right, that union didn't take place until 1707, I think. Let the tape note that I'm staring at our English subject that's in the audience, and he gave me a blank look as to whether 1707 was the right year or not. I'm pretty sure it was 1707 when the crowns were actually joined. But in the event, it looked like a possibility at that time, and obviously one likely outcome of such a merger would be merger of the two churches. So that was caused considerable concern, and in fact, the ministers did succeed in getting Parliament in appointing these commissioners to the meeting on union to actually exclude from their realm of authority anything to do with the church. So, okay, well, the General Assembly was scheduled to meet in July of 1604, but James postponed the meeting until the meetings on the union were over. And the Presbytery of St. Andrews instructed their representatives to go anyways. And when they found no one present, they wrote up a formal protest in the presence of witnesses that they had done their duty, and that whatever injury might arise to the liberty of the church from the desertion of the diet shall not be imputed to them or their constituents. Well, James continually postponing this thing, right? The last had met in 1602 and set the date then for 1604. The fact that he postponed it indefinitely at this point got the church somewhat more concerned. So there were a number of petitions that came from presbyteries and synods who were still meeting. He also canceled the July 1605 meeting and canceled it without saying when it would be held, if ever, this as if to declare that the king had the whole power of calling it into his own, on his own authority. So, nine of the presbyteries decided to send representatives to Aberdeen, where it would have been held, and to hold a brief meeting of the General Assembly. Anyways, and the purpose of the meeting was simply to schedule a meeting. So all they were supposed to do was meet, set a date for the next meeting, and adjourn. But when they did try to meet on the 2nd of July, 1605. A messenger at arms came in and forbade them from meeting, and told them to disperse or they'd be charged with rebellion by order of the king. So they told the messenger they wanted him to appoint a date for the meeting. When he refused, they went ahead and set one for September 1605. Well, when the king found out about this, and now keep in mind he's roughly 400 miles away, he was furious, and his Privy Council in Scotland. It didn't upset them too much, but when he found the news, he was quite furious. So he ordered that the ministers, at least 14 of them, to be proceeded against. So they threw 14 of them into prison immediately. And six were eventually indicted for treason. And the reason for being indicted for treason was that they refused, when they were called before the Privy Council, they refused to acknowledge its authority over them having this meeting of the General Assembly, because they said it was a purely ecclesiastical matter. So this was a declinature. Okay, well, they packed the jury, and so the Crown was able to obtain a conviction. But in fact, the conviction... let's see. The conviction didn't carry with it an immediate penalty. They were just thrown back into prison while the king figured out what he was going to do. But there's actually a letter, a quote from a letter. this is the Lord Advocate sent to the king, to dissemble nothing if the Earl of Dunbar had not been with us, and he was, the Earl of Dunbar was sent to prosecute the case, and partly by his dexterity in advising what was fittest to be done in everything, and partly by the authority he had over his friends, of whom a great many passed upon the assize, and partly for that some stood awe of his presence, knowing that he would make faithful relation to your majesty of every man's part, the turn had not been framed so well as, blessed be God, it has. So by sort of manipulating things, the men on the jury were ones that were subject to the size to be taxed, and the level was still to be set. And so they knew that if they misbehaved, the level might be set a lot higher. So they were able to obtain a conviction of those six. And then James wanted to try the remaining eight, but the Privy Council told him it would be impossible, that they wouldn't be able to get the same men on the jury again. So it turned out, though, that the eight that remained, they were ended up being... Yes?
I'm having a little trouble figuring out how this flows. I know I missed some. Huh? But I'm having trouble figuring out how this...
Yeah.
Tell the story of James and the history of Scotland. I'm sorry. Maybe it's just me. Does everybody else understand it?
Well, look, I don't really want to have a discussion of who understands it and who doesn't during class. I'd be glad to discuss it later, but to go back to how this flows, what James is in the process of doing right now is intimidating the church. The way you intimidate the church, or one way, is to persecute the ministers of the church. And in this case, he's going to banish eight of them to, today it's not so remote, but to the Highlands, the Western Isles, to Orkney, and to Shetland. And by banishing them, he gets rid of the eight, well, he gets rid of actually 14 altogether, because the six that are convicted... of treason, or thrown in prison for 14 months, then they're banished to France. Okay, so he gets rid of actually 14 ministers that are troublesome, and that that intimidates the rest of the church, so it helps him get his way. So that's how I would say it fits into the flow of the history here.
What happened before that?
Well, we've had just a whole... Yes, this is after he became King of England.
But it sort of follows a pattern. It's just that he's put more teeth in it now, right? I mean, this was...
Yeah, it follows a pattern that he had established before he was... when he was King of Scotland, where it basically... it's a pretty familiar cycle. It follows... he intimidates, he throws somebody into prison, or, you know, orders them around. Then he comes up and he acts conciliatory, but he kind of gets them to... persuades, sort of, if you will, the weaker-minded members of the church to sort of agree to some halfway measure that doesn't sound too bad. They, in fact, gets them to, you know, say, approve. No, they weren't just sitting there saying, okay.
What were they doing?
Well?
Is this the history of the church or the history of James?
This is the history of both. And yeah, as I've said every day since I've been here, it's a tale of two kingdoms. Okay, let me see if I can pick up the flow of where I was. Okay, James apparently now confident that the church was sufficiently intimidated. He ordered that the provincial synods be assembled. And they were supposed to approve five articles. The five articles would have approved, among other things, of the king's right to summon assemblies and to appoint bishops. And all but one of the synods refused to approve the articles. They basically said that they would turn it over to the General Assembly, which of course hadn't met. So James, having failed there, turned to Parliament. And Parliament met in Perth in August of 1606. The primary purpose of the Parliament, what they did, they passed a number of acts related to the bishops. And what they, in the end, did was establish them to have the same authority, the same, well, maybe not complete, same complete spiritual authority, but the same they gave them the same land back, rents, tithes, all the trappings of sort of hierarchical authority they had in society. So in fact, it reversed this act of annexation in 1587. So 42 of the ministers signed a protest, and that protest really covers what their opposition was to the issue of bishops. let me quote from this, at length from this protest. "Set me up these bishops once, called long since the prince's led horse things. If they were never so unlawful, unjust, ungodly, and pernicious to kirk and realm, if they shall be borne forth by the countenance, authority, care, and endeavor of the king, supposing such a one as God forbid, come in the room of our most renowned sovereign. For to the best hath oftentimes succeeded the worst, they shall be carried through by his bishops, set up and entertained by him for that effect. And the rest of the estates not only be indeed as ciphers, but also bear the blame thereof to their great evil and dishonor. If one will ask, how shall these bishops be more subject to be carried after the appetite of an evil prince than the rest of the estates? The answer and reason is, because they have their lordship and living, their honor, estimation, profit, and commodity of the king. The kings may set them up and cast them down, give them and take from them, put them in and out at his pleasure, and therefore they must be at his direction to do what liketh him. And in a word, he may do with them by law, because they are set up against law. But with other estates he cannot do so, they having their heritable standing in their rooms by the fundamental laws, or then but a commission from the estate that send them, as from the burgesses or barons. Deprave me once the ecclesiastical estate, which have the gift of knowledge and learning beyond others, and are supposed, because they should be, of best conscience. The rest will easily be miscarried. And that so much the more that the officers of state, lords of session, judges, lawyers that have their offices of the king, are commonly framed after the court's affection. Yea, let chancellor, secretary, treasurer, president, controller, and others that now are, take heed that these new prelates of the kirk, as covetous and ambitious as ever they were of old, insinuating themselves by flattery and obsequence into the prince's favor, attain to the bearing of all these offices of state and crown, and by the exercising thereof, as craftily, avariciously, proudly and cruelly as ever the papistical prelates did. For as the holiest, best, and wisest angels of light, being depraved, became most wicked, crafty, and cruel devils, so the learnedest and best pastor, perverted and poisoned by that old serpent with avarice and ambition, becomes the falsest, worst, and most cruel man, as experience in all ages hath proved. If any succeeding prince please to play the tyrant, and govern all, not by laws, but by his will and pleasure, signified by missives, articles, and directions, these bishops shall never admonish him as faithful pastors and messengers of God. But as they are made up by man, they must and will flatter, pleasure, and obey man. And as they stand by affection of the prince, so will they by no means jeopard their standing, but be the readiest of all to put the king's will and pleasure in execution, though it were to take and apprehend the bodies of the best, and such namely as would stand for the laws and freedom of the realm, and to cast them into dark and stinking prisons, put them in exile from their native land, etc. The pitiful experience of times past makes us bold to give the warning for the time to come, for it hath been seen and felt, and yet daily is, in this island. And finally, if the prince be prodigal, or would enrich his courtiers by taxations, imposts, subsidies, and exactions laid upon the subjects of the realm, who have been or shall be so ready to conclude and impose that by Parliament, as these who are made and set up for that in the like service. Okay, so these bishops would, you know, when fully established, do just really what they say, and that is they do the king's bidding. And they do the king's bidding not just in ecclesiastical matters, but also in other matters. Right? And James, as we know, felt himself to be an absolute and free monarch. And because he had a parliament, he wasn't quite an absolute and free monarch, but by sort of packing the parliament with these, he came a lot closer. So this is a warning to the parliament against this, and notwithstanding this protest, parliament went ahead and enacted the acts that the king wanted. So, I think we'll probably, let's go ahead and stop there. I might just say that in sort of succeeding years, say in the next 4 years or so, the bishops were appointed to be what are known as constant moderators in the synods and presbyteries. Okay, and so that in effect means they run the meetings, and you know, we have a benevolent moderator at our church, but you know, but if you don't have one, someone who can sort of organize the whole meeting has a lot of power. So. Okay, questions?
A thought just occurred to me. I've been really, in the last few weeks, really wondering why James was so interested in the church. But it seems to me that perhaps, and maybe you can comment on this, perhaps it's because at the time, controlling the church would be equivalent to controlling the media today. These guys, this seemed to be the way that the daily news, the weekly news got out, at least. And I wonder if that might explain some of his preoccupation with manipulating the message of the church. Or were there other outlets? I mean, did they have daily newspapers or weekly newspapers? Or was this about it in terms of interfacing with the masses, so to speak?
Yeah, as far as I know, they didn't yet have newspapers. I mean, they were still issuing proclamations by nailing something up to the market cross in Edinburgh, for example. This meeting of the assembly, you know, that took place in Aberdeen, where the king took such offense at the local representatives claimed afterwards that he had nailed a proclamation to the market cross the day before, but which he apparently didn't. So being partly media, sure, that's a way. I think it's a way to affect the hearts and minds of people. I mean, you have to keep in mind it's not like today. First of all, almost everyone went to church. They all went to the Church of Scotland. There wasn't, like in this town, 53 different churches of 17 different denominations or whatever the statistics are. That was part of it. Part of it was also simply that James thought he knew best, that he could organize the church in such a way that was really the best way. Now, you could question what his motives were for doing that, but, I mean, it's very clear. You know, I contrasted him with Elizabeth earlier. She was, she wanted to control things, but she forbade discussion of issues and so on, and tried to do it in a way that just sort of squelched everything. And James wasn't so much interested in that. In fact, he really enjoyed theological dialogue. So I guess you could say partly this was his hobby. Maybe was interfering with the church.
Are you serious? Do you really think James enjoyed?
Well, he's a very
complex.
Oh yeah, I think
absolutely.
Because so. One thing that's coming out is this guy is a very complex person.
Oh yeah.
And I was amazed to hear that he could actually, and would even bother to read scripture in the original languages with a view to turning up problems in the translations.
Yeah.
I mean that's incredible.
Yeah, now why he did that, of course, maybe political reasons, but
oh, sure,
he, No, he definitely enjoyed. I mean, he carried on lengthy. When he was king, he carried on lengthy dialogue, you know, correspondence with people on the continent and so on, debating issues. So,
well, I guess if he was brought up in the church under, you know, the Protestant leaders, and that was the order of the day.
Yeah, it was the order of the day. I mean, he was certainly had the kind of education that, which took religion, theology very seriously. So, and he was he was extremely bright. I don't think there's, you know, he made all these brags about he could do more work than five men and so on, which were ridiculous. He definitely. You know, was extremely bright. There's no question about it. And even if you see how he went about getting his way, which is the history I've been trying to trace, of how he keeps sort of interfering with the church incrementally and, you know, kind of goes, sometimes he intimidates, sometimes he conciliates, sometimes he packs the General Assembly by getting all these ministers from the north who he's fawned over. After that, he... Bob?
I mean, to sum all that up, he's basically a tyrant.
Yeah.
So, what I wonder is, what was the Protestant response to his tyranny? I mean, he stopped on the rights of all these ministers. What was the Protestant response to someone's rights being totally stopped on? People being falsely accused and thrown in prison and all that kind of stuff. And what did the Protestant, how did they respond to that?
We sort of talked about this last week, in fact. But I mean, the problem was, I think it was the consensus of this group, that the church didn't put him under discipline for his excesses or his sin. And I think that was probably I think we agree that that was
Yeah. Rob, can we let someone else ask a question here? Mike's had his hand raised, so Mike, please.
The thing that does not go in this deal of two kingdoms, it appears to me that when Christians take on the secular world, per se, Christians lose, because in the sense that they're coming up against a conniving kingdom, and Christians on the whole have this idea of looking at the best of people, and by looking at the best of people, you cut them a lot of slack. From the time you get finally dawns on you that it's too late, you do it. How do Christians stop? You know, it seems to me that that's just a cross we have to bear, in the fact that we're always going to get the worst into the sick in most of these things, because we're going to think the best. And the time we wake up to these things, the cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for you, except to say that, okay, just a second, that they definitely were... They were gullible, and I think that's, you know, you're right, that they tended to put the best face on things. They tended not to, the king would make a sort of a pious, flowery speech, they would tend to accept it at face value. And, you know, you're going to see this again and again throughout the history, that they, you know, you look after the fact and say, how could they have believed that? But yeah, I think you're right. Dan, I'm sorry, you had the answer.
My answer was perfect for results. I mean, I think that is probably a legitimate answer too. You don't try to figure out how to judge these people yourself, how to cut them off yourself, but you pray that God will do it, and He will in His time.
But also, think about what we have to deal with as Christians when we read that we're supposed to obey the rulers, you know, to the best of our ability. That automatically gives them an upper hand. I mean, because they got to go really. It's going to have to be blatant times it dawns on you what's occurring.
Right, and then it always becomes sort of a wedge issue inside the church, because some people always want to go farther in obeying the authorities than others.
And we all want to love.
That's right. Yeah. So, okay. Other questions? Rob, go ahead.
So who do you actually means after Yannicka? States or churches? James or the other body?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by the end. Certainly, this the church wins out at least until the end of the, I would say, until the end of the protectorate, right? Once Charles I has his head cut off, you know, the church is pretty much won the day, and we'll sort of see the sort of high point of covenanting sort of ascendancy in terms of influence over this, the society in, say, the 1630s and 1640s. James, of course, thought he was very clever, but his biographer points out that this, like, Hampton Court conference where he came in and immediately alienated the Puritans, in fact, unleashed the very things that eventually resulted in his son's head being cut off. The church, in that sense, the church won, but then, you know, when Charles II got back in, and it's much more the same sort of gullibility that Charles II, you know, signed the covenants and everything, and, you know, then there was a real period of persecution until 1688. And after, I think in general, after that, the church won, although the Scottish church really was never the same again, so.
Isn't it really a statement of faith? Isn't that really a question of faith? Not really settled in that day and age?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in a sense, it's not settled today either, right? So that's why.
Well, but don't we have a Bible that settles it?
In the long term, I think so, yeah. I think it does. It's not really. So when you ask the question, who won, it's a sense of the now and the not yet. We're certainly much better off in terms of liberty. What's it? You can lose in the short term. I mean, I know what you're saying. Yeah, I know what you're saying. But
whether you sink or swim, get back, spin, never die, you're not going to lose.
Yeah. No, okay. Yeah, I agree. So. Would you close this in prayer, Mike?